Okay, so today I'm going to give a talk on a case from the Blue Cliff Records, case number 91, Encan's Rhinoceros. This case is considered one of the hardest cases in the curriculum, so I apologize to the new people, this might not be so easy to penetrate. Nevertheless, we're going to unpack it and you might get something out of this. The Blue Cliff Record is a collection of koans. We have 100 koans in the collection that was collected in the Song Dynasty. Like most koans, they actually originated from sayings in Tang Dynasty between masters and students, or masters if you like. And there were dialogues that were collected by various monks and actually inscribed on stone in some cases. That's how they know that they're quite authentic, because archaeology sort of supports the written document as well. So the dialogues that are in the koans always refer to the ultimate, the non-dual aspect. And that is why it's difficult for people that haven't had an experience of the non-dual world, if you like, to sometimes penetrate what is meant. Having said that, we all get different things out of koans. So even when our clarification process is quite advanced, there's always something else that we can get out of a koan, and this is a good example of that as well. So the original compilation was done by Secho in the Song Dynasty. And then about 100 years, Engo was another master. He then wrote the introduction to it. So there's an introduction to the case, then there's the case, and then there's the verse. And the verse was also written by Secho at the time. So all the different books, we have about 5 books in our lineage that we... that students are asked to penetrate. So each koan, you know, all up about 600-700 koans. Each koan is always about the same thing, always about the great matter, always about our essential nature, always that way, always looking at it from that aspect. But at the same time, it does that through language, and it does it through the dualistic way of perceiving. So what that means is that we get hooked all the time on this because our dualistic mind is so prevalent in our day-to-day deliberations that we can't always see the essential aspects of a koan, and because of that we might not necessarily penetrate the depth that is required when we work with them. So anyway, I'll read the introduction, and then I'll read the case, and then I'll read the verse separately. But let's start with the introduction. So I'll read it out first, and then we'll look into it. It transcends feelings and is removed from personal views. It breaks free of fetters and loosens all that is sticking, to bring forth the highest truth of the essential, to uphold the treasury of the true Dharma eye, you must be able to respond appropriately in the 10 directions. You must be completely transparent wherever you are. This is a state you must directly attain to. Just tell me, is there anyone of the same attainment and same realization? Anyone who dies together and lives together with this? To test, I'm citing this. Look. So that is now pointing to the koan, which we'll go through later. The first thing is, let's just go through it line by line. It says it transcends. It transcends. It breaks free. What is this it it's talking about? So that's the first thing. It breaks free. What is this it? You know. So of course we can add names to this. We can say it is our essential nature. It is. If you're a Christian, you might say it's God. If you're a Buddhist, you might say it's Buddha, or it, or Buddha nature. You know, In Zen, quite often we use the term our essential nature. So it transcends feelings and is removed from personal views. Then the next word, transcends, you know. It goes beyond, it transcends feelings, it goes beyond, you know. So to transcend feelings, you know, there's a whole subject matter. How do you transcend feelings, you know? So depending on the Buddhist tradition that you follow, you know, some people put a lot of emphasis on these different stages of transcendence or of feelings, and they look into it in a very, very minute and deliberate way. So what does transcend feelings means? So quite often in Zen, we don't actually talk about that because we're, you know, Zen very much focuses on the mind. So we say, you know, Zen is a mind purification practice. But at the same time, Zen is also a it's also a heart purification practice, not just a mind purification practice. And I think one of the reasons that Zen sort of puts so much emphasis on the mind and freeing the mind is because, you know, the original purification of heart, in other words, having a really strong moral compass, having a really strong authentic, pure heart, was almost taken for granted before you get to the mind stage, you know. So remember that Zen is a monastic tradition. So if you became a monk or a nun, the first thing that they all, you know, that they all are subjected to is the Vinaya, which is the moral code, you know. Even laity, you know, laity is, in the classical Buddhist traditions, is given the precepts as their first practice, you know. And it's once that has been, once the precepts or once that moral aspect of our nature, of ourself, has been mastered to a certain degree, then you come on and start working on the mind purification practice. So in many ways, it's very much preliminary. In Zen, as I said before, the emphasis seems to be on mind. It's very much a teaching from the top down rather than from the bottom up, as I keep on saying. So it teaches from a non-dual aspect rather from the dual aspect, which is very much what other traditions are doing. So in that sense, it has a different method than some other traditions have. But coming back to this now, heart purification, that also is a process. You know, we cannot all of a sudden, you know, say, okay, I want to be pure now and I want to be a really good person now. All of a sudden, bingo, we're pure or we're a good person. It just doesn't happen that way. It's a process. And the reason it is a process is because we all of us are at a different stage. And the reason we are at a different stage is because we are conditioned all differently. And that conditioning brought us to where we are now. So if I get upset about something, whether it is a minor thing or a major thing, it's because I'm conditioned to get upset because of that. You know, even when I look at my past, even my memories, you know, my memories continuously change. You know, I might think like, oh, something happened to me in the past, and I might be able to let that go, but actually, I can't let it go. Why can't I let it go? For starters, I'm changing the story all the time. We're always changing the story. As we, you know, it's like our body. When I look in the mirror, I go, is that really me? You know, when I think back only a few years ago, I look differently. Our body changes. We were a child. We become an adolescent. All of a sudden, we are an adult, and our body changes. So do our memories based on conditions that are happening today. So when I look at something that annoyed me 20 years ago, or if I have an ailment with or a disagreement with someone that happened maybe 10 years ago, the way I look at it today is completely different to when it actually happened because of conditions that I am a completely different person today than I was 10 years ago. You know, I might be harder, I might be softer, I might look at it differently. We don't have a save as button when it comes to memories. So our memories play tricks. And because of our memories playing tricks, our emotions play tricks. So something might trigger us in a certain way, you know, but that has in many ways nothing to do with the original the original issue. It is always, everything is continuously moving along and continuously being conditioned all the time. Okay. But I don't perceive it that way. I perceive it as me, subject, there, object, and I perceive the injustice. And so all of a sudden, this whole, where do my feelings come from? It's just a continuous process of happenings that contribute towards that. So purification, if you like, of the heart is first of all seeing that these are everything that is happening in me that I think is right or wrong, or it is happening in society that I think that is just or unjust, is the way I look at it based on a conditioning process. It's got nothing to do with anyone else. You know, it's all me that is doing it and creating it. You know, so getting to that point of seeing things, this is what I feel is meant, like it transcends feelings. You know, it as in when we see it, you know, it transcends feelings. You can see through that, and is removed from personal views. So of course, those of you that know a little bit about Buddhism, personal views is in contrast to right view. So right view is part of the Noble Eightfold Path. Number one path element is right view, to see things as they are, to see things very clearly as they are, versus my personal view of it, you know. So if I get triggered in any way, if I get upset in any way, that always comes back to a personal view, rather than seeing things as they are, because seeing things as they are is always, it's just a fact. It's just no. It's itself. Seeing things as they are is just mentioned before in the lectures upstairs. If we hear a noise, it's just a noise. I don't like that noise. It's already adding, you know. So seeing things as they are, it doesn't matter what it is, to see things as they are versus the personal views. You know, the reason we are entangled and the reason we suffer is because of personal views. We keep on getting stuck in personal views. You know, we don't, at that moment of suffering, don't see things as they are. If we would, we would just see, oh, I've just added this. And that adding is optional. I can add it any which way I like. I'm free. I can add meaning, and I can add, and I can non-meaning, and I can add good, and I can add bad. I can add hot. I can add cold. I can add it. And that is never it. It's just a story. And that story is based on my conditioning, the way I have conditioned myself, you know, all along the way. You know. So it says it transcends feelings and is removed from personal views. You know, it transcends feelings and is very powerful. It transcends feelings and is removed from personal views. It breaks free of fetters and loosens all that is sticking, you know. So fetters are chains, you know, like prisoners' chains, you know. What chains us, you know, that's what it breaks. It breaks us free of all that is chaining us. Of course, it's talking about non-dualism here. It's talking about our essential nature. It breaks free of all that chains us, you know. Classically, also, I'd like to just mention that classically, there are 10 fetters in Buddhism that need to be overcome to be enlightened, to become an arahant, you know. And these are different stages over different lifetimes. Whether you believe in lifetimes or not, it doesn't matter. But originally, in early Buddhist teachings, this is what was taught. And it just might be worthwhile just going over those 10 fetters very briefly, or just to list them anyway. So the first 3 fetters are identity view. So if we have an identity and we hold on to that identity, this is me, that's the first fetter. Okay, that's number one, identity view. You know, can I get rid of my identity view? Can I see non-self? Can I see non-self? You know, because of course, Buddha's first realization was non-self, you know. Everything is I, not I separate, you know. Non-self, so identity view. Doubt in Buddha, or when I say Buddha, not the historical Buddha, but doubt in the awakening of a doubt in this aspect of Buddha, if you like, of awakening of this. There's many words that we can use for Buddha. So please don't get stuck in Buddha as an historical figure here as Buddha, but doubt in Buddha as in, yeah, he's a model and he's shown the way, if you like. But the doubt of it has gone. That's another fetter. If there's a lingering doubt, then we haven't overcome that fetter according to early Buddhist teachings. And then the next one is ritual rules and ascetic rules. You know, all rules, all rituals, you know, we need to let go of them. You know, so if we are still stuck in rituals, that is this ritualistic way. And keep in mind, this might not be difficult for us, because generally most people hate rituals. So this might not be difficult for us. But in ancient India, when this was first came up 2,500 years ago, rituals were the way to salvation. You know, when you look at Hinduism, for instance, or you look at the Brahmins, they were the holders of the ritual truth, and they were the communicators with the gods. So rituals got them actually. The rituals were a way of liberating. And they used to pay them. Even still today, if you go to India, you pay someone some money and they all of a sudden do a ritual and that frees you in that moment. They're so attached to rituals, they thought that a certain rituals would free them off, you know, of whatever it is that they wanted freedom from. So these are the three lower fetters. And once they have been abandoned, those three lower fetters, according to early Buddhism, then we enter the stream, meaning stream entry. Then you enter into a path of no return. In other words, it only takes you seven lifetimes to get enlightened from that moment on. So that is the classical teaching of early Indian Buddhism. Okay. The next one is a once returner. So, you know, but we don't know where we're at. The way they classified different attainments is to the degree that which you have let go of the fetters is the degree to which you are awakened. So this is according to classical Buddhism. So the next one is a once returner, and those three views are part of that as well. Then comes a non-returner, in other words, one more lifetime to go before you become a Buddha or an Arahant. And that fetter is much more difficult to let go of, that fetter, or to let go of that hindrance. You need to be able to let go of sensual desire and ill will, completely let go. Again, keep in mind, this is a monastic. You know, of course, monastics, they're home leavers, they are renunciants. Their whole practice is to renounce. What do they renounce? Desire. Desire is the cause of suffering. So their whole life focus becomes renouncing desire. So that then becomes, once that has been mastered, sensual desire. And sensual desire is anything, whether that is anything to do with the senses, the desire to touch, to eat, to hear really good music or entertainment, sexual desire, of course. All of these desires will have to disappear. And then ill will, you know. And then you become an Arahant, which is like, you know, that is like the definition of in Mahayana, we would say a bodhisattva, and in the Theravadan tradition, early Buddhist teachings, an Arahant is like a perfected one, you know. And they then let go of material rebirth desire. They don't want to be reborn again. Immaterial rebirth desire, conceit, restlessness, and ignorance. So these are the higher fetters. And once you get to that stage, there's no more rebirth. So for those of you that know, normally we don't talk about these things in Zen because this is classical Buddhism, but I think it's nevertheless worthwhile just mentioning so that you're aware of it. And I'm not sure whether, you know, in the introduction here, it means exactly those fetters. But of course, we've got enough fetters in our day-to-day life that we can work on without having to go into the others. But funnily enough, all the fetters, all the chains, everything that binds us somehow, you know, when you look at it and then you compare it to that list, it always comes back to one aspect that is on that list. You know, desire being a really big one. So it transcends feelings and it's removed from personal views. It breaks free of fetters and loosens all that is sticking. So sticking, it loosens all that is sticking. Sticking here is attachments. It loosens all the attachments. Because ultimately, that is what is sticking. That is what is holding us, but what is holding the fetters you know, we have these attachments that we cannot let go of, and that while we have those attachments, we are stuck to the chains through those attachments. To bring forth the highest truth, to bring forth the highest truth, the highest truth of the essential, you know, of the essential. So what is the highest truth? You know, so, you know, quite often people want to find the truth. The truth shall set you free. The truth. What is the truth? You know, the highest truth of the essential. And I came across this poem by Walt Whitman, American poet. Beautiful, beautiful poem. And when I read it, I thought, wow, this guy knows the spot. You know, and this to me is the highest truth of the essential. He wrote, "Meditating among liars and retreating sternly into myself." You know, meditating among liars and retreating sternly into myself. You'd almost think he was in prison or somewhere, you know. Meditating upon among liars and retreating sternly into myself. I see that there are really no liars and lies after all. I see that there are really no liars and lies after all. And that nothing fails its perfect return. Like a lie. Nothing fails. It's just perfect. There's just a perfect return. But what I add to it is lie or truth. Nothing fails its perfect return. Seeing the perfection. Not what I add to it. You know, it's perfect return. And that, what I called lies, are perfect returns. That's what I call lies, are perfect returns. And that each thing exactly represents itself and what has preceded it. And that the truth includes all. And that the truth includes all. Let's get that. The truth includes all. And is compact. Just as much as space is compact. And that there is no flaw or vacuum in the amount of the truth, but that all is truth without exception. All is truth without exception. And henceforth, I will go celebrate anything I see or am, and sing and laugh, and deny nothing. It's just beautiful. That is Walt Whitman, you know, wrote this 18-something rather. I mean, to be in that space where he can see that, you know. So this to me very much is to bring forth the highest truth, you know, to see things as they are, you know. That's the highest truth. To bring forth the highest truth of the essential. Of course, of the essential. We're talking about the essential. When we go back into the relative world, we have to distinguish between that which is truthful and not truthful. But that's another realm. That is another realm. To bring forth the highest truth of the essential. To uphold the treasury of the true Dharma eye. So Dharma here, capital D, the way it is. The true Dharma eye, to see things as they are, to see it with it, to uphold the true Dharma eye every day, to see that amongst all the lies and amongst all the killing and amongst all of whatever it is that is happening in the world, to see the true Dharma eye, you know, that is integration. To be able to see that amongst all of that. All of that relativity that we are confronted with, whether that is through television or whether that is in the traffic or whether wherever that is, you know. You must be able to respond appropriately. So this is now, and this is a lovely word, appropriately, because if we respond any other way, we can become fundamentalists. You know, this is the truth, not that is the truth. This is it appropriately. It's with total flexibility. It's to be able to see that. And because we know everything is so different, there is no one standard answer or one standard truth. We must be able to respond appropriately. And of course, that is the task of a bodhisattva. And in Zen, you know, rather than an arahant, quite often the ideal is someone that has mastered this, goes back into the marketplace and responds appropriately. That is sort of the highest level in Zen. Someone that has mastered, you know, all of this, goes back into the marketplace and responds appropriately, according to our respective vocations. It's another word that we chant, according to our respective vocations. So it doesn't matter whether that is being a mother, or whether that is being a plumber, or whether that is being a doctor, or we all respond appropriately according to our respective vocations. It says here in the 10 directions. So the 10 directions, up, down, sideways, I forget what the other ones are. You must be completely transparent wherever you are. You know, again, another beautiful word. You must be completely transparent wherever you are. No stickiness. You know, transparent as in what you see is what you get. But no sticking at all. No preferences in many ways. Preferences is, again, what I add. Completely transparent wherever you are. This is the state you must directly attain to. This is what he says in the introduction. This is the state you must directly attain to. Just tell me, is there anyone of the same attainment and same realization? Anyone who dies together and lives together with this? So is there anyone? Do you know anyone? Is there anyone like that, you know? Dying together and living together, like completely at one, this seamlessness. No death, no life, just this seamlessness. To test, Engel says, I'll give you an example. And now we come to the case, which is the koan, which is the example. Now this koan, I find it quite humorous because it is a play on words. Okay, it's a play on words. But of course, we add meaning to the words, and that's when we get entangled. You know. So the idea now is to untangle this koan. Okay. Untangle it, but untangle it from the perspective of the essential nature of that truth part, the truth without, you know, there being anything other than truth, you know. So that is not that easy, okay. So, but anyway, I find this quite humorous, you know, in this dialogue. It's a play, if you like. It's a play, but it can be challenging to understand. Okay, so I'll read it out first, and we're going to go through it line by line. Okay, one day, Enkan called to his attendant, bring me the rhinoceros horn fan for me. Bring the rhinoceros horn fan for me. The attendant said, the fan is broken. Enkan said, if the fan is already broken, bring me the rhinoceros. The attendant was silent. Toso said, I would not refuse to bring it forth, but I fear that the head and horns would not be complete. Secho commented, saying, I want the horns which are not complete. Sekiso said, if I return to the masters, there will be nothing. Secho interjected, saying, there is still a rhinoceros. Shifuku drew a circle and then drew the character for rhinoceros in the center. Secho commented, saying, why didn't you bring that forth before? Hofuku said, the master is advanced in years. It is better to ask another. Secho commented, saying, what a shame, all that effort with no results. Okay, so here we have this very, very famous koan. Okay, so let's go through it one by one. One day, Enkan. See, Enkan was a student of Basso, famous Basso, so Tang Dynasty, 6th, 7th century roughly in China. And he called his attendant, bring me, like a simple thing, oh, can you just bring me my phone? Same thing, bring me my phone, someone bring me my phone, or bring me the rhinoceros fan. Of course, a rhinoceros fan is a very highly, you know, priced object. I would imagine the fact that it came made out of a rhinoceros horn and all of this, you know, it would have been quite an expensive fan, and even in those days. So bring me the, so it's a very natural thing to say, bring me the rhinoceros fan, bring me the phone, can you bring me a glass of water, whatever, you know, very natural. But of course now all these players come in and they take it apart. They take this, you got to look at this, they take this whole thing apart, okay. The attendant said the fan is broken, okay. So Encant sees here an opportunity for teachings. He says, oh, it's broken, huh? It's broken. He said, oh, well, if the fan is broken, you know, bring me the rhinoceros. So if the fan is broken, bring me the rhinoceros. First of all, if the fan is broken, yeah, we've got to first understand what is rhinoceros. For those of you that are working on moo, you know, I always say, what is dog? If you work on moo, you know, you've got to understand what dog is. You know, what is rhinoceros in this case? What is rhinoceros? You know, so rhinoceros, it does come back to dependent origination in many ways, in the sense that there is nothing but allness. Like this, the same as the truth part that I talked about before. There's nothing but truth, you know. These are, of course, words that just point to it. They are in itself not it, because they're words that point to it. But you could argue that they're it itself too, of course. But bring me the rhinoceros. It's like, bring me this, bring me essential nature. Bring me that part, the rhinoceros. Bring me I alone. Nothing but rhinoceros. So it's broken, okay. So here's this play between this the relative way that we look at it and the ultimate way that we look at it. Okay, relatively, there's a fan, there's a computer, there's a phone, there's Maggie, there's Raph, there's, relatively, it's separate, okay. So the attendant says, it's broken, okay. So there's broken and then there's not broken. There's broken and then there's whole. And he's challenging him and he's saying, oh, if the fan is broken, bring me the rhinoceros. So the first question is, how can anything be broken? It's the same with, how can anything not be the truth? If I say, this is a completed stick, okay, but I can argue it's broken. Why is it broken? Because it used to be a branch on a tree, it's broken. You know, that's a broken branch, but all of a sudden, no, it's not a branch. It's actually a cat. It's a very, very important stick. The computer, you know, is broken. Why is it broken? Well, it comes from brokenness, if you like. The computer is broken in that it's nothing but brokenness, because what is it made of? Plastic. Where's plastic come from? Oil. Someone had to extract that oil. Where does the oil come from? Sediment. From what? Decomposed from billions of years worth of organic matter that eventually came into this ground as oil. You know? Everything is broken. And at the same time, there is nothing that is broken. Nothing can be broken. Impossible. From that perspective. To say it is broken is like dividing it up. How can that be divided? How can that computer is nothing but parts? Where do those parts come from? It goes back all the way to the Big Bang, if there ever was such a thing. You know, billions and billions of years of evolution has created this computer. And evolution of not just organic matter, but evolution even of science and humanity and all of this to bring this here. So every object that we see, including ourselves, you know, is nothing but the whole. But of course, our individualistic mind, our separative mind, if you can call it that, is continuously looking at that's broken, that's whole, that's the truth, that's not the truth, you know. So he's saying is, Chanya, the attendant said, the fan is broken. And Enkan said, ah, there's a, of course you can say that the fan is broken, but there's a teaching here. Can he see that world of oneness through penetrating what brokenness means? You know, it's broken. Enkan said, if the fan is broken, bring me the rhinoceros. Oh, that's a big one. Bring me the whole thing if the fan is broken. Okay? Bring me the truth. If everything is truth, bring me the truth. So it's, again, this goes into, you know, form is emptiness, emptiness is form. You know, like I said, is that which one? You know, one is the other. One is the other. The attendant was silent. Now, some people believe, you know, when you read different commentaries about this koan, that the attendant was had some idea of realization, idea of what it was. He was silent, which was like, I don't want to get involved in this discussion. It's not going to get me anywhere. Or he was dumbfounded. He didn't know what to do. Okay, that is another way of looking at it. Toso, the Nasa master, now he added his comments to this. And he say, I would not refuse to bring it forth. But I fear that the head and horns would not be complete. I would not refuse to bring it forth. But I fear that the head and horns would not be complete. Okay, two things. Bring it forth. Another one. There's another fetter that we have. That's another chain. Bring things forth. I need to bring things forth. Maybe I don't bring things forth. How is this? What is that? Bring this. How can you bring anything from that world of oneness? How can anything, how can you, how is there even a you? How can I bring anything forth? You know, he's saying, I would not refuse to bring things forth, but I fear the head and horn would not be complete. What's complete? What's completeness? I fear that it would not be complete. How can there anything be complete? So this is what he said, I fear it would not be complete. If I bring anything forth, I fear it will not be complete. You know, I can't show you allness if I fear it would not be complete. So that's his take. Now, Secho added, I want the horns which are not complete. And this is funny because he's saying, what do you mean not complete? There's something that is not complete. Show me that which is not complete. You know, this is you got to see this, that there is no such thing as complete and there's no such thing as not complete. What do you mean not complete? It's complete right there, complete. You know, this is not complete right there, not complete. You know, you've got to be able to see that. And these are, of course, where these are our fetters. These are our, this is our way, our language and our way of looking at it through this logical, dialectical way that we trap ourselves. It does not in many ways, if we see it only through that perspective, through that eye, it doesn't allow us to see the wholeness of it. So we need to, in a way, free ourselves of this. And this is what this koan is meant to do. So in the Dokusai room, when we come to that, you need to be able to see that and present that. Secho commented saying, I want the horns which are not complete. Let me see those incomplete horns. Go on. Where is anything that is not complete? Show it to me. Sekizo now said, if I return it to the master, there will be nothing. If I return it, so again, what do you mean return? How can I return anything? If I return it to the master, if I return it to the master, so there's returning, is there? Everything is everything. If I return this, I cannot return anything. The computer is everything. It can never be returned. I mean, you might say that eventually this is going to get dumped. It becomes landfill. And then what? In 1,000 years, it'll be topsoil. And then out of that topsoil, a tree grows. The computer is nothing other but tree. You know, and then in another billion years, it might be oil again. It's oil. So no matter what happens, you know, in the scheme of things, nothing can be returned. Why? Because it is it itself. And also because it is empty. Empty of what? Empty of itself. Nothing has its own. There is no computer here. It's empty of itself. There is no self in computer. It's just parts. What are those parts? I can go back all the way. There's nothing there. You know, I just call it something. And it's impossible to return. Impossible to return it. Who are you going to return it to? Me? So, anyway, you've got to see the funny side of this. If I return to the master, there will be nothing. There'll be nothing, you know. You know. Secho interjecting. Secho is quite a funny guy. Secho interjecting, saying, there is still the rhinoceros. Don't forget the rhinoceros. So he said, there is still the essential nature. You know, you've got to see that. There's still the essential nature. You know, there is still the rhinoceros. Right there. There's the rhinoceros. There's still the rhinoceros. Sekiso drew a circle and then drew the character for rhinoceros in the center. So he drew a big circle, Sekiso. So there's another personage. He drew a big circle. So that was his presentation. And then he drew the character for rhinoceros, Chinese character for rhinoceros in the circle. So that was his presentation of it. So that was his comment to it. And remember that in the Dokusan room, for those that are new, you always ask, okay, how do you present this? How do you present this? So we have a series of presentations here in this koan. So how do you present this? So that's what his presentation was. He said, so he just drew a circle, put the character of rhinoceros inside the circle. Now, Secho commented saying, why didn't you bring that forth before? Why didn't you bring that forth before, you know? So obviously he liked it. Why did he like it? The others were debating. He just presented it. You can't argue with a presentation. That's it. You can call it truth, you can call it the rhinoceros, you can call it broken, you can call it unbroken. Whatever label you want to add to it, go for it. But that's it. Whatever label you want to add to it, that's it. You can do that, of course. But that's why didn't you bring that forth? It's a perfect presentation. Now we've got another character here, Hofuku. Hofuku said, the master is advanced in years. It is better to ask another. So his comment is, oh, I'm too old for this. I am too old for that. Go, please ask someone else. That's what he's saying. Go and ask someone else, you know. And Secho commented saying, what a shame. All that effort for no result. So this is also an interesting comment. He's saying, you know, again, it's a presentation. I'm too old for this. Go and ask someone else, you know. So quite often in Zen, you have people that are silent, like the attendant, silent. Or you have any type of presentation, you know, of the matter, of the fact. You can have many, many different presentations of the fact. So here, he said, I'm too old for this. You know, go and ask someone else. And so Secho, in a way, you know, you can see there's two aspects to Secho's comment here. He's saying, what a shame. You know, all that effort with no results, you know, meaning that, you know, we can do that. We can be silent about something. It might be absolutely perfect, but it hasn't got any power. You know, there's no results. In other words, we could all do what Goethe did, lift the finger, but it's got no power. You know, it's got no power. You know, in many ways, we need to get in the mud. You know, that's what he's saying. You need to get amongst it all, you know, for it, you know, to stir things up, for there to be any change, you know, in whatever, in people seeing it or whatever it is. So that's another way of looking at Secho's comment. Okay, then we get to the verse. I'll read it out first. The rhinoceros horn fan can be used at any time. If you ask about it, you have never known a thing. The clear wind and rhinoceros horns are without end, but each of them would be difficult to chase after as the rain when it has passed. Setcho spoke again. If you want the clear wind and horns to appear again, I ask that each of you Zen students produce a turning word. He asked, saying, if the fan is broken already, bring me the rhinoceros. At that time, there was a monk who stepped out and said, all of you, go to the Zendo. Setcho cried out, Akatsu, and said, I let down my hook hoping to fish up a whale and only brought up this little frog. Thereupon, he descended the rostrum. So the rhinoceros fan, starting off the first line, the rhinoceros horn fan can be used at any time. The rhinoceros fan can be used at any time. The rhinoceros, there's actually no one there. Let me see if I can turn this off. No, I can't. So it can be used any time. The rhinoceros fan can be used at any time. Form, like millions of ways. The rhinoceros fan can be used any time, any which way you want, you can use it. You know, the rhinoceros fan can be used at any time. If you ask about it, you have never known a thing. You know, if you ask about it, you've never known a thing. Again, here, this is not easy. You know, if you ask about it, if you are looking at it from you, and that's what we do, we self-reference all the time. If you're looking at it from a you perspective and you ask about it as it being separate, that's why if there's me here and you there, or I'm here and the truth is out there, you have never known a thing. You've never known a thing. You know, there's a famous story that transcends religions. It started off in pre-Buddhist, in the pre-Buddhist tradition, in the Hinduism even, about blind people. You may have heard of it. Blind people trying to figure out what an elephant is. So these blind people are brought together, and there's this huge elephant. And each person looks at it, and one person looks at it, and he goes to the trunk, and he thinks that the trunk is a snake. It's like a snake. And another one that goes to the feet, and he touches the feet, and he says, oh, no, that's a pillar. And another one goes to the tail and sees the tail and says, oh, no, that's a whisk or whatever it is. And another one goes to the ear and says, oh, there's a piece of leather here. Yeah. So that particular simile is quite famous, because quite often the way it's interpreted is that all these blind people are all the different religions, you know. They're all the different religions interpreting their perspective, but none of them can see the whole. It's a little bit like that, you know. If you ask for it, you know, he is saying, you have never known a thing. The clear wind and rhinoceros horns are without end. So the clear wind is that aspect of non-duality, and the rhinoceros horns, the duality, those, that emptiness and form, the clear wind and the rhinoceros horns are without end. Without end, say. The clear wind and the rhinoceros horns are without end. The clear wind and the rhinoceros horn are without end. But each of them would be difficult to chase after as the rain when it has passed. But each of them would be difficult to chase after as the rain when it has passed. It's like when a storm passes, blue sky, you know, where is it? Blue sky. Each of them, you know, each of them would be difficult to chase after. Really difficult to chase after. I mean, how can you chase after this? Each of them would be really difficult to chase after. You know, like, we want to hold it somehow. We want to somehow perceive it. We want to define it. But each of them would be difficult to chase after as the rain when it has passed. It's like drinking a glass of water. Thatcher spoke again. If you want the clear wind and horns to appear again, I ask that each of you Zen students produce a turning word. So a turning word is like a word that gets a student to realize, you know, to let go of their delusions and realize the way things are. That's a turning word. And throughout history, we can see that different people, you know, through stories, and that's not just in the Zen tradition, also in the Christian tradition and other mystical traditions as well, that a turning word or a turning encounter somehow gets one to realize, just like that, you know. So he's asking the assembly, I ask you to give me a turning word that ensures that you will have that you get it, that you see that vision, that you see that transformation from the dualistic to the non-dualistic, the turning word. I ask that each of you Zen students produce a turning word. He asks, saying, if the fan, so it's the same question again, if the fan is broken already, bring me the rhinoceros. That's the question. That's the question in the Dokusan room. If the fan is already broken, bring me the rhinoceros. At that time, there was a monk who stepped out and said, all of you go to the Zendo. So is that a turning word? All of you go to the Zendo. So he just stepped forward. All of you go to the Zendo. Setcho cried, Katsu! Katsu! He shouted. Just this! You know, he shouted. He said, I let down my hook hoping for a fish to fish up a whale and only brought up this little frog. So he's criticizing this poor monk, you know. He says, I gave you a hook, you know, I've been talking about this, and all I get is this this little frog on the line, you know. And then he descended the rostrum.